Hello, everyone, and welcome to the High Stakes Success Podcast. I'm your host, Jesse Day, and today we have a really amazing guest with us. It is professional MMA fighter Gurdashan St. Lion Mangat here with us today. Awesome to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here, man.
Great.
I didn't know what fighters trained. I didn't know what fighters ate. I didn't know what training was like. I didn't know. I just know that you could fight and there'd be crowds around and people cheer. And that was enough for me to. But I really didn't know what I was. I didn't know what the weight classes even were when I started. I didn't even know who was a top fighter. So I knew nothing. I went into it with nothing. And I almost think that's one of the best things about it. I didn't overthink the process.
Well, so that may have benefited you, actually.
It hugely benefited me without kind of realizing it. And I tell people this a lot of the time. I'm like, as the fights go on, like now I'm going on to my, I think it's like my 19th fight altogether, but 11th pro fight overall. I feel more nervous now and more anxiety now because I know what the pain feels like.
Right.
I know what things feel like because I have the experience. But when I went into my first MMA fight, I really had nothing to base it off of. And I kind of just went in there and I won it and I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know what it was going to feel like. Now, as time builds, as much as you're gaining experience, you're also remembering what it's going to feel like 10 minutes before you walk out.
Right.
What it's going to feel like on fight day, how your stomach's going to be turning, how the emotion, you know that process and it messes with you here and there.
Okay, interesting. Let's talk a little bit about that, the emotional state right before a fight and how you overcome that. You mentioned you get actual physical sensations like a turning in the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of question yourself in that
everything.
One moment?
You question everything. You really do. The one thing that I don't question ever is my training.
Right.
Because I'm a workhorse. I surround myself around people that just work their asses off. One of the biggest things is that I say that fear, when you train hard, your fear turns into confidence. So that's what happens. Every day I can't sleep. I have insomnia. I think about my opponent, what he's doing. But then I'm in the gym working. So when the fight day comes, that all that fear that was built up, all that anxiety that was built up now becomes confidence. So I don't slack in my training. It's only through hard work and all that where it ever becomes. I'm not naive where I'm sitting around watching TV. I'm like, oh, he's probably not training. Don't worry, I'm confident. I'm going to knock him out. No, it's. I like believing that my opponent is always training harder than me. That's what gets me to keep pushing, whether he is or not. I don't know. But with just the idea of that is what gets me to push past my own boundaries all the time. And so when the fight day comes and I'm sitting in the change room, all I do is just replay my training. I'm like, I've done everything. I haven't cut any corners. Like I was just telling you before we went on air, I drive down to Seattle train with Demetrius Johnson.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that don't want to drive a 10-minute drive to go to the nearest gym because they're like, it's a bit too far for me.
Right.
I cross the border. I sit in hour border lineups. Then I drive to Seattle just to do about 35 minutes of work, five-minute rounds with the champ.
Right.
Then I'm back in my car. And I'm driving 2-3 hours back, sitting at the border. And that's a day right there. So that's 6 hours of driving for 1 hour of quality work where a lot of people won't even drive downtown and be like, so that's the thing when I wake up every morning on Saturday, I'm like, do I really want to drive there? But when I'm sitting in the change room before a fight, I'm like, I did all that.
Right.
I made all the sacrifices. I did everything. I invested every part of myself. I sacrificed everything. And that's where all that comes into play.
That's awesome. So speak a little bit about a training camp and basically how long it is and the process that you go through before a fight. Like once you know that you're fighting an opponent, do you start training right away or do you break down tape of them? How does that whole process work?
I don't take off seasons. I'm always active at all times, but there is a mindset switch that happens.
Right.
It's more fun when you're not training for a fight, but you're just in the gym, just getting better with guys when you're helping other guys. But when you know you have a fight coming up, mentally things switch. The work, when you don't have a fight, sometimes you do 3 rounds. You're like, you know what? I was in here. I was active. I did my rounds. I did my wrestling, did my sparring. But when you have a fight, you push to those 6-7 rounds.
Right.
You don't leave because you're like, this is training camp now. That's about the only thing that changes. Me and my team, we don't take times off. So it's not like I go away until I sign a fight and then all of a sudden I show up at the gym. I'm in there every single day, 2-3 times a day with my team. And we're growing every single day. But when one of us has a fight coming up, the mentality changes.
Right.
That's the only thing that changes about it. And then from there, I'm training about 2-3 times a day. I'm driving. I have my meals with me. I have meal prep. Everything gets very catered to that. As far as it comes to whoever I'm facing, I really don't study opponents anymore. I don't see the benefit in that. Like, obviously, you want an overview of what they look like, who they are. But you got to remember, just like I'm in the gym getting better, so are they. So I can't base it off of a fight even 3-4 months ago, because I would go back and study my own fights instead and see what he's looking for and beat him to the punch of what he's looking for. I don't care what he's doing. I want to see what he might be looking in me by studying myself. So I'm always overall trying to just round myself up, not base it off one opponent and be like, oh, his stand-up's not that great. I guess I'll focus on kickboxing. No, overall, I work all aspects, conditioning, wrestling, jiu-jitsu, the nutrition, everything is catered. It's a lifestyle. It's not a hobby. It's not like I turn this off and then I turn it on in the morning. This is what I obsess over. I sleep over. I manifest over. I visualize over. I do the work of, and that's what I live. I'll bring out that point. An actual training camp is only about 6 weeks for me.
Okay.
Like where it really kind of turns up. I've noticed that I don't need the long ones anymore because I'm in training all the time.
Right.
So if I have more than that, then I mentally burn out a bit. Just constantly think about the same thing. 6 weeks is enough for me.
Right.
Usually. And that's when I peak perfectly and stuff like that. I'm still ready to go to the fight and stuff like that. I don't feel like it's been dragged on. And I like that a lot better now.
Hey guys, welcome to the High Stakes Success Podcast. I'm your host, Jesse Day. And today we have NASCAR driver Alex LeBay joining us. How are you doing there, Alex?
Pretty good, pretty good. What about you, Jesse?
I am doing great.
I mean, you're never, I don't think you're never in shape enough. It's just like any other sports. If you're really, on the best of your shape and you can stay focused for all your race, every single lap, every single corner, you can be 110%. I mean, that really helps compared to a guy that's not as healthy and is not as in shape. And like three quarters in the race, he's starting to give up. Speed on the track, and I mean the guys are working all week to get the car prepared, and they're busting their ass to get everything perfect. So I mean, if you're in the car and you're 50 laps from the end and you can't even drive it to what it's capable of, I mean it's not doing your job right, I think.
So how about the heat? You said the heat is very intense, and that's a big part of it. So how hot does it get in there, and is it crazy uncomfortable? How do you deal with it?
Yeah, it's pretty uncomfortable. I mean, it depends. Like at this time of the year, when the season starts, it's not as bad because temperatures are a little cooler. But when you get in the middle of summer, like during the month of, like July, June, end of June, July, and it's pretty tough. I mean, you gotta be in pretty good shape, really well hydrated too, because you gotta deal with a lot of heat, and that's tough because you sweat a lot and you lose a. You lose a lot of energy. I mean, you got to be pretty healthy, especially at that time of the year, because there's a lot of guys that sometimes they pass out because they're fully dehydrated. So you got to that's probably the worst part of the sport, middle of the summer, to deal with the heat, because you lose a lot of water during those races.
So people are passing out in their vehicles, basically.
Yeah, some guys, I mean, it already happened. Some guy just did an accident, just passed out and hit the wall. That's pretty bad. And sometimes, like, guys just pull out because they feel like they're really close to
pass out.
And they pass out just right when they get in the pit. So it's pretty bad. It's pretty tough with the temperature, I'd say, during the middle of the summer.
Wow. Have you ever had that experience where you felt like you were getting a little lightheaded and that maybe you should stop?
Yeah, especially in the first, like in the first years of my career, I've already been sick like once or twice. But after long, long races, like 200 laps races, and I mean, one time when I won my first race, I did like an hour after my race, I was sick like a couple of times because I was so you're dehydrated and you got a lot of gas fumes. I mean, like the exhaust and everything. And
yeah,
that's what's tough to deal with. I mean, there's the heat and there's the gas all the way, all the gas, the smoke from the exhaust and all that stuff. It's pretty tough to deal with because everything you breathe is not good air, and it's hot, so it's tough sometimes. That's like I was saying, that's really the tough part about it.
That's intense. So I guess that's where the physical preparation does come into play. The healthier you can be going into it, the more likely you'll be able to resist these sort of effects and finish the race.
Yeah, for sure. Finish it. I mean, optimally too. And there's, I mean, if you don't want to give up anything on a track, I mean, you've worked all week to get to that point, the last 20, 30 laps. So that's really where you got to be on your game, and you can't be out of shape during that and not be up at the maximum of the car.
So how long do these races run for typically?
It depends which races, but it's mainly around like 2 hours and a half to 3 hours. It depends where oval road courses and all that stuff, but it's around, I'd say around 2 hours and a half. So it's pretty long.
That is especially long.
Yeah, especially when sometimes we race during the day and sometimes during the night. At least at nighttime, there's no sun. It's a little cooler, but it's still pretty hot. There's still a lot of humidity sometimes, like at nighttime. So it's that's what's tough when it's really humid. There's no hair, so that's the toughest part.
I want to go back to your training and talk about the simulation. You mentioned something about simulations and going online. What is that?
There's a pretty good platform for, especially for, not for stock car, but just for motorsport in general. It's iRacing. It's a lot. It's a big community, and they're everybody's racing online. And it's like a simulation. It's not really a video game. There's a lot of engineers that updating the software all every week with how the car reacts and all the tracks are. I mean, every bumps and every. It's just as close as possible to reality as you can get, and we're all racing online against one or the other every week. So that really helps the competition. It's just like real racing. We got like three screens, and we can see inside all the on both sides. So it's just you race in traffic, and you race just like when you race your race car, but you do it online.
So you have a setup like a steering wheel and stuff like that.
Yeah, steering wheel, three screens, and. It's all on a PC, on a computer. So, yep, it's pretty, I think it's the best thing to stay sharp.
And welcome to the High Stakes Success Podcast. I'm your host, Jesse Day. What do you do if you're lost and stranded in the wilderness? How do you survive? I can't think of a more high stakes situation than that. So we've got a very cool guest on today. We have Nick Buck, who is a wilderness survival instructor as well as a professional mountain guide, to talk to us all about wilderness survival.
People have sat down and died. It's as simple as that. People have given up. Some people give up before they leave the house each morning, and some people are just very negative. At the other end of the spectrum, you get incredibly positive, strong-minded people. You know, the Navy SEAL Marcus Luttrell, who recounts the tale of finding himself smashed to pieces but reaching forward with one arm and scratching a line in the sand and dragging himself to that line and saying to himself, if I can drag myself to that line, I'll just drag myself to the next line. And he did that for X many miles. That's the mentality you must have, the sort of not dead, can't quit mentality. That coupled with the ability to remain calm, cool, and collected and assess a situation and think about it rationally. Assess what are the challenges presenting themselves to me, how can I best overcome them?
Wow, that's powerful stuff. That's got like parallels to life, I feel.
Absolutely. Ways, right? We find that a lot of our students stay in touch with us, and we've seen a lot of changes. You know, we work with a number of youth groups, and we take them out into wilderness situations, and we teach them these very sort of, you know, a skill set that may seem very practical and perhaps limited in its scope and its use, but we find seeing some of these youth years later that the skills and lessons learned out there, the harsh realities of life on the mountain, carry forward and carry across into other aspects. In fact, I would say every other aspect of a person's life. Yeah.
Wow. And yeah, I guess when you're kind of, you've trained and you're good at being able to survive in that sort of situation in the wilderness, other things in life seem a little bit easier by comparison, I would imagine.
When you've been up at 8,000, 9,000 feet and the snow's coming up at you, and you've got a person with a broken leg and hypothermia, and you somebody's lost a satellite phone and somebody's dropped a bag of food, something as simple as a breaker going in an apartment block or a truck breaking down on the side of the highway seems really manageable after that.
Yeah. No doubt. And that kind of segues into what I wanted to ask a little bit about, which was survival in different environments. Like you mentioned, a snowy mountain, and by contrast, a desert where it's very hot and there's no water, obviously. So what are the methods of survival in these different sorts of environments?
And one of the things we would do as part of our preparation would be to learn as much as we can about any and every environment that we're going to go into. You know, before you get on a commercial airliner, learn about the countries you're going to be flying over just in case the worst happens. So if we're heading into, for example, the mountains, you would want to know as much, you would want to know everything about them, but you would want to make sure that you were carrying as much information in your head as possible. And that would help you prepare properly, because ultimately, when presented with a survival situation, we sit down, as I've said, and we assess what are the challenges before us, and we think of the rule of threes. And the rule of threes is a little memory technique to help us prioritize the way that we are going to beat these challenges, meet the challenges, beat these enemies that are up against us. So most folks have got an idea in the head that they're going to either be attacked by a grizzly bear or starve to death. And statistically, unplanned wilderness scenarios don't end through starvation or animal attack. So the rule of threes would very simply say that you're going to survive for 3 minutes as a guideline without oxygen. Well, you know, for your average person on the street, we're not discussing egress from a helicopter that's in the water, etc. So that brings us on to the next challenge. Hey, I'm breathing. I'm going to last longer than 3 minutes. Now what's going to kill me? And in a cold, wet, snowy mountain environment, it's going to be hypothermia, okay? Hypothermia, the lack of your ability to retain your body heat. Now, we're going to be preparing for that in a certain way, but that is going to apply in any environment. Now, of course, in a desert environment, it would be hyperthermia that is going to kill us. Too much body heat. It doesn't matter. We arrive at it in the same manner. We arrive at it. It's the first priority is stabilizing and controlling our body temperature, maintaining proper thermoregulation. For example, in a mountain environment, you're going to want to be able to erect a shelter within 5 minutes and to start a fire in the next 5 minutes. Okay, within 10 minutes, you ought to be able to erect a waterproof, windproof shelter that helps to create a microclimate and a fire. Those two things working properly in conjunction with each other are going to allow you to survive longer than the 3 hours, which is the next aspect of the rule of threes, that hypothermia would render you up the creek.
Hey guys, here we are on this episode of the High Stakes Success Podcast, and today we have a really awesome guest. It is Scott Schiffner. He is a bull rider, and he has been voted Cowboy of the Year here in Canada, as well as a bunch of accolades, including Olympic bronze medalist and so much more. So we are now joined by Mr. Schiffner. How are you, sir?
What's really changed over the years, you know, and I'm one of the few guys that can say this for how long I've been around is, you know, when you're younger and that we're traveling and we're getting on, and the biggest issue with us is we're sore and injured a lot of the time. So training becomes a challenge, right? Because you're always trying to protect something that's injured and that, but we still do it. And now my training is very heavily on cardio. We'd go to the gym and that, but we're not big into lifting weights and that, you know, the PX90 stuff and that. We do a lot of stuff like that, right? Cause it's all about staying, you know, limber and moving around and just being able to handle our own body weight. But we always have to adapt to something that's sore or something that this and that. So it's a little different that way. And it definitely has progressed. Bull riding has become a long ways where guys now actually do treat themselves as athletes and go, where years ago they didn't. We just went and got on and got in a vehicle and went to the next one and had a beer and got on the next one and away you went, right? So it's evolved and it's got way more professional, which is a great thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the reason it's come that far is you asked too about the bulls and that. Well, the bulls have dramatically changed so quick in the last 10 years, especially because it's turned into a multi-million dollar business. Bucking bulls are trading for just like racehorses now. There's a bucking bull that a year and a half ago, they turned down half interest, 50% shares of him, and they turned down $2.5 million for him, right?
Wow.
Which is unbelievable to me. But the Embles now are all on, they're on special diets, they're on exercise programs and that. So they're athletes within themselves, but they've surpassed us as bull riders so quick because they've modified everything with, you know, different types of AI and different cows and embryo transfers. And within 3 years, they can build a pretty amazing bucking bull where it takes 18 years to build a pretty exceptional bull rider. And we don't really build them the same as we build the bulls. Like they just, that's what they're to be. And we still try for everybody else to just be regular people. Right. So it's a neat industry that way.
So is there, there's actual like kind of, you could say genetic manipulation of the bulls themselves. Like they're actually created to be bucking bulls for the competition.
Exactly. It's just exactly like the racehorse industry, you know, it's just right. like that. It's, you know, what they've done is they're not, I wouldn't say like modifying them, you know, taking this and that, but they're taking semen from the best bull and putting it in the best cow and definitely controlling what offspring is coming out. Right.
Right.
And then when they find a great mix, what they can do is they can take one cow and they, what would they call flusher and get 10, 12 embryos and then put that semen in there. So they can get a crop of 15 to 20, you know, calves, all identical, all full brothers and sisters out of one cow within 1 year. So that really pushes the envelope.
Now, we are an audio and video podcast. You can find us on YouTube and iTunes and everywhere where podcasts can be found online. We'd really appreciate it if whatever platform you are watching us on, you do give us a rating, a like, and a comment about the show. We'd really appreciate it. And as always, you can find us at highstakessuccess.com. So stay tuned next time for another amazing guest. And remember, when the stakes are high, success is the only option.